Let me welcome you once again to the Gathering Storm CD. My name is Dr. Andy Woods, and we begin really a series of studies related to the whole issue behind the gay agenda. In our first CD together, one of the things we looked at was the biblical side of the equation. We examined the Bible on the subject. We noted that there was a concerted effort to rewrite the Bible so that it accommodates the homosexual lifestyle. And during that first CD together, essentially what we did is we went from Genesis to Revelation, and we showed that God's Word all the way through promotes heterosexuality and condemns homosexuality. God loves the homosexual, but the sin that they are enslaved to, the very sin that is destroying them, as a matter of fact, is something that God does not support nor condone. And so we handled that biblical side of the equation in our first lesson or CD together. Then we moved into our second CD together, and that's where we began to look at not just the biblical side of it, but now we began to explore the political and the theological angle of the gay agenda. And you will recall last time that sadly we ran out of room, so that's why I'm taking the liberty to sort of wrap up our thoughts on this third CD together. But we saw that the gay rights agenda is all about victimhood. In fact, in a 1987 article written for Guide magazine, a homosexual publication, and this article was written by Marshall Kirk and Erastus Pill, they lay out the agenda for overhauling straight America. And number one on their agenda is to portray gays as victims, not as aggressors. And you'll recall that we read excerpts from that article. You might recall these words: any campaign to win over the public gaze must cast themselves as victims in need of protection, so that straights will be inclined by reflex to assume the role of creator. And consequently, we studied very carefully how the gay agenda is all about piggybacking the civil rights movement and the Civil Rights Act of 1964, just as blacks and Hispanics and Asians and women and a number of other minority groups are given elevated protection under the law, what we call civil rights protection. The homosexual movement wants that same protection for themselves. The problem is the gay movement intellectually does not fit the criteria that one must meet in order to receive civil rights elevated status. You have to demonstrate that you're a sizable demographic. You have to demonstrate that you have some kind of immutable characteristic. You have to demonstrate that that characteristic is harmless or innocuous. And you have to demonstrate that there has been some sort of historical pattern of discrimination against you. Now, blacks obviously meet those four criteria. But in our last CD together, I walked you through very carefully why homosexuals do not fit those criteria at all. And yet, even though they don't fit the criteria, they are on the verge of achieving this civil rights status. Well, it's not needed. And why do they want it? They want it because of that 1987 article written for Guide magazine. I made a mistake in the prior CD. I think at the end I said it was written for Parade magazine, but that's not right. It was written for Guide magazine, a homosexual publication. And they want it because their goal in overhauling straight America is to portray themselves as victims. You see, once society looks at you as a victim, then you get elevated protection under the law. And guess what you can do with that elevated protection? You can use it as a legal weapon to punish or silence any institution or organization that happens to hold to the biblical position on homosexuality, that homosexuality is immoral. That's why this victimology and this victim status and this elevated civil rights protection is so significant. You know, just like let's say a black person goes into a restaurant and they're discriminated against because of their skin color. Well, because they have protection, rightfully so, under the law, they can take that business to court. And what gays are trying to do is they're trying to obtain that same status for themselves. Therefore, any organization that has a moral position on homosexuality, whether it be a Christian bookstore, a Christian radio station, a Christian-owned and operated business, or even a church, once that civil rights protection is afforded, they, through the same force of law, can take to court and sue essentially any business they want to that they feel is taking a moral or a biblical position on homosexuality. They won't call it a moral and biblical position. They'll call it discrimination. Just as a black person can rightfully sue any business that discriminates against blacks, gays who want this civil rights status want the same legal arsenal that they can use to take to court any institution that takes a biblical or moral position on homosexuality. And that is the name of the game. Now, this all relates to something that I call Sodom's second coming. Because Jesus himself said, "As it was in the days of Lot, so shall it be." We saw in the days of Lot that a militant homosexuality had arisen, where mere criticism of the homosexual lifestyle was reacted against violently. Jesus says, or predicted, I should say, that that same moral climate would reemerge and reassert itself in the last days. And guess what, folks? We're here. The things that Jesus predicted would come are happening. We made reference to Revelation 11. In verse 8, we have a reference there to the city of Jerusalem, and it describes the moral climate of that city. Now, this would be Israel or Jerusalem in unbelief before she is converted in the events of the tribulation period, but this is what it says. Speaking of the two witnesses, it says their bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is mystically called Sodom in Egypt, where their Lord was crucified. Now, when it says where their Lord was crucified, we know that that's the city of Jerusalem, because that's where Jesus was crucified. And you'll notice that city by John under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit in the book of Revelation is given the designation mystically, not only called Egypt, but also called Sodom. So it's talking about the moral climate of that city. And if it can get this bad for God's city, Jerusalem, think how much worse it is for the world in terms of this moral climate. Sodom would bring to mind Genesis 19, the moral degeneration of that city and how mere criticism of the homosexual lifestyle, any insinuation that somehow the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah were abnormal, that criticism was reacted to and reacted against violently. You recall that Lot had offered this crowd that had gathered outside of his house, he had offered this crowd his virgin daughters. And the crowd took great offense at that. And they said, "Who are you to judge us? Why are you acting as our judge?" Genesis 19, verse 9. and they proceeded to break down his door. They said, we're going to treat you worse than the two men that we wanted to sexually abuse. And when Jesus says, as it was in the days of Lot, so shall it be. And Revelation 11 and verse 8 talks about Jerusalem, mystically called Sodom. I believe what the scripture predicts is that same moral climate will reemerge just prior to the return of Christ. And so we're seeing reemerge here a militant homosexuality. And as I've tried to argue, they masquerade as victims so that they can get elevated civil rights protection under the law. And once they get that protection, they can then use it as a weapon to silence legally any opposition. Anybody that wants to stand on the biblical position then becomes a target of a lawsuit, just as discriminating against a black person rightfully brings retaliation legally, rightfully so, I might add. But they want that same status for themselves as is given to African Americans and other racially ethnic groups, minorities, and they want the power to sue or to attack legally anybody that has a biblical or moral position on homosexuality. I've described how this comparison between your status as a racial minority is totally different than one's status as a homosexual. And so any attempt to equate the two, to my mind, is an apples and oranges sort of comparison. But this is the very thing that's going on. And eventually the homosexual movement will get this legal weaponry that they're seeking. And they're seeking for it so aggressively because Jesus predicted that the same moral climate that existed in Genesis 19 would reassert itself just prior to the return of Christ. That's essentially the ground that we've covered. And as society moves into this very degenerated state, we can expect certain things to happen. We can essentially expect a loss of freedom. And I gave you some examples from different books and recent news articles about people that are losing their freedom because of this gay agenda and Sodom's second coming and this elevated status under the law that the homosexual community has been able to successfully attain for themselves. But one of the things that has happened, and I believe this is where we left off last time, is this extremely harsh reaction against Governor Mike Pence. Governor Mike Pence signed into law an act called RFRA, R-F-R-A. It stands for the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Once he signed that into law in the state of Indiana, it was somewhat astonishing, the harsh reaction against him. Even the CEO of Apple began to criticize him. A neighboring governor, Terry McAuliffe, used the opportunity to invite Indiana businesses to uproot and move to Virginia. The Final Four, which was scheduled to be played in Indiana, was threatened. You have a lot of high-profile Americans and entertainers that have criticized Mike Pence. And why the reaction? What did Mike Pence sign into law that was so terrible? Well, really, what he signed into law was not terrible at all. And the reason I say that is because that law was signed into existence at the federal level by none other than Bill Clinton in 1993. Bill Clinton signed into law a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And in fact, that particular act was originally introduced by Chuck Schumer, a very far left-wing politician. Clinton, of course, is a liberal Democrat. So two liberals Schumer and Clinton were instrumental in getting that law passed at the federal level. And what's very interesting is George Stephanopoulos, who was part of the Clinton election team back in 1992, interviewed Governor Pence and charged him with anti-gay legislation. Well, that's sort of odd, isn't it, George Stephanopoulos, since your own boss signed a comparable federal version of the law back in 1993. So my point is simply this. There is nothing anti-gay about RFRA, the Religious Freedom, the Restoration of Religious Freedom Act. Had that backwards. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act. There we go. There was nothing anti-gay about that, because if there was anything anti-gay about it, why would it be supported by Clinton, a liberal politician, and Schumer, a liberal politician, when their core constituency consists of gay activists? That makes no sense. Beyond that, the law passed the Senate at the federal level 97-3. That's a very lopsided vote, isn't it? And the law was completely reasonable. It had to do with a Supreme Court case entitled Employment Division versus Smith that passed in 19 or became case law in 1990. In that particular case, what had happened is the standard that must be shown by the government before it can trample on religious freedom was lowered. It involved peyote and drugs and things of that nature, and most people believe the Supreme Court and their desire to win the drug war went too far and lowered religious protection. I won't get into the details of the case, but that's kind of the nitty-gritty of it. So what the government had to show in order to interfere with religious freedom was lowered, and all RFRA did, as sponsored by Schumer and signed into law by Clinton, is restore the standard back to where it was before the Supreme Court lowered the standard. And this law was so common sense that it passed in 1993 in the Senate with a 97-3 vote. 97 of the 100 senators in favor of it, only 3 against it. And since that time, there have been 20 versions of RFRA around the country, at various states around the country. What is very, very interesting is this law, RFRA, a state version of the federal law, was passed into law by the state of Illinois in 1998. And guess who was in the state Senate in Illinois at the time? A man by the name of Barack Hussein Obama, who eventually became the President of the United States. And Barack Hussein Obama voted in favor of that legislation while he was in the Senate. So if this law was somehow anti-gay, as everybody's making it sound, why would Obama vote in favor of it? Why would Schumer, a far left-wing senator, sponsor it? And why would Clinton sign it into law? These are all very liberal politicians that supported the law. And it's well known that these liberal politicians are heavily backed and financed by the gay lobby. Now, beyond this, RFRA has been in existence for, over 20 years, I believe. And you'll notice this fact. No RFRA has ever been successfully used to defend anti-gay discrimination. Not in 20 years of RFRAs nationwide. In fact, in one high-profile case from Richland, Washington, involving a Christian florist who refused to lend her services to a gay wedding, quote, the couple had no problem getting the flowers they needed. In fact, they received several offers for free flowers. So here you have a homosexual couple. They went to a Christian-owned and operated business. They essentially wanted this Christian-owned and operated business, this florist, to provide flowers for their gay wedding. The owner of the business refused. Why did they refuse? Because they have a biblical conviction, if you will, about homosexuality. And now this couple, they had no problem getting another business to give them the flowers they wanted. In fact, according to the news article that I am quoting from, an article from a publication called Canada Free Press, the couple had no problem getting the flowers they needed. In fact, they received several offers for free flowers. So what's the point I'm trying to make? The point I'm trying to make is RFRA is not discriminatory against gays, despite what everyone will tell you. But you see, we're in this climate now where any criticism of the homosexual lifestyle is reacted to in a very aggressive manner. And what's so sad is Mike Pence signed this legislation, even though there's nothing anti-gay about it. And because this law gives churches and pastors and Christian-owned and operated businesses the legal right to say no to the gay agenda, he was resoundingly criticized from top to bottom. And he was so strongly criticized that he even ended up backing off his position. So I am using this to simply explain the things that are happening in our culture as Sodom's second coming materializes. The gay agenda is advertising itself as a victim. Consequently, they're getting laws changed, and now they have weapons in their arsenal to punish and silence anyone that would have a moral objection to homosexuality based on the Bible. And even the small legal remedies that we do have through RFRA, and how it cannot be demonstrated any real discrimination against gays. They simply protect people of conscience and people of faith. Even individuals that are in favor of those types of laws, like Mike Pence and others, are thoroughly, thoroughly criticized. So what is happening as we're moving into this culture of Sodom's second coming, what we're seeing over and over again is a deterioration or a loss of religious freedom. It's not difficult to document this. I did it in the last CD by reading from the foreword, rather, from a book called When the Wicked Sees a City. I read also from the back cover of the book, a book published in 1993. And it's a documentation there, historical documentation, and I encourage people to get this book and read it, of the horrors and the terrorism that Chuck and Donna McElhaney went through because they spoke out at city council meetings against the gay agenda. They were leading the first Orthodox Presbyterian Church in San Francisco. They had their home firebombed. Their kids were terrorized. This book explains it all. Why? Because they simply spoke out against the homosexual lifestyle. I also had an opportunity in our last CD together to read a little bit out of a book entitled Our Gay Rights Right, written by Roger Magnuson. The subtitle of it is Making Sense of the Controversy. This was originally published in 1990. And we talked at that time a little bit about Hacklander and Roe and the horrors legally and the stress they were put through by the Madison Equal Opportunities Commission, otherwise known as the MEOC, simply because they were searching for a roommate. A person showed up on their doorstep wanting to rent space from them as their roommate. who happened to be a lesbian. They politely told her they weren't interested. And she reported this incident to the MEOC, and this book by Roger Magnuson documents the legal problems that Hacklander and Roe were dragged through, the legal mud they were dragged through, simply because they expressed a moral conviction about homosexuality. And so as the gay rights agenda has been able to successfully position itself as a persecuted minority deserving of civil rights protection, they now have legal weapons in their hands. And as what Jesus says, as it was in the days of Sodom, so shall it be, as that mentality descends upon America and culture and civilization in the final days prior to the return of Christ, what we are seeing more and more is these laws being used to reduce religious freedom and to make life difficult for people of conscience who happen to have a biblical view against homosexuality based on the Bible. So that sort of catches us up to where we are. What else will we see happen in this new moral climate that we find ourselves in? What we're going to see more and more is the homosexual lifestyle being taught in the schools. Now, let's think about this just for a minute. In our last CD together, we demonstrated that about 2% of the American population is homosexual. So we're talking about a small group of people. Beyond that, it's quite obvious that homosexuals cannot reproduce, they cannot have children. So how does a 2% of the population keep itself alive? How does it keep itself active? How does it keep itself ongoing? How does it continue to manifest itself as a presence with only 2% of the population with no ability to reproduce or bear children? Well, the obvious answer to that is they have to recruit. Now, what are they using to recruit? They are using the public schools, as I'll show you in just a moment. And this is why the argument that 10% of the American population is homosexual is such an important argument for their lifestyle. If 10% of the population is gay, and we start believing that 10% of the population is gay, then there must be a lot of confused youths out there that are gay, but they just don't know it yet. I mean, if 10% of the population is gay, certainly there's a lot of people out there that are kind of on the fence. Maybe they're sexually confused, and they just have to be talked into the homosexual lifestyle through some sort of guidance counselor. And you see, that's why this 10% figure, even though it's a discredited figure, is something that is repeated over and over again by the homosexual lobby. After all, if you repeat a lie long enough, as the famous saying goes, people will eventually believe it. So when you hear this figure that 10% of the population is gay, number one, don't believe it. It's from the discredited Kinsey study. But number two, understand that this is part of the gay agenda. It's part of the statistics that they use to justify using the public schools for purposes of recruitment. Are gay activists using the public schools for purposes of recruitment of young people into the gay lifestyle? Frankly, I believe that they are. And I'm reading now from an article published on April 20th, very recently, 2015. It's an article about a lesbian teacher named Pam Strong in Toronto. Now, we might say, well, this is Toronto. This doesn't affect America. So this is in Canada, right? And the answer is yes, this is in Toronto, but, you know, quite frankly, I don't think our country's that far from Canada, certainly not geographically, and we're really not that far away from them morally either. So what happens and is happening in Canada is rapidly coming to the United States of America. But at any rate, the title of this article is Lesbian Teacher, How I Convince Kids to Accept Gay Marriage, starting at 4 years of age. Now, that number there, 4 years of age, is interesting because there's a big push to start public schooling for children pre-kindergarten. Matter of fact, I remember when Obama was running for president, one of the things he said that he wanted to do is he wanted to start education very early, 4 years old, 3 years old, and so forth. Well, now we learn why they want to start education that early. We want to indoctrinate children while they're very young into either becoming homosexuals themselves, and if they're not going to be part of this 10% that's going to be homosexual, then we want to develop a society, in essence, which is very accommodating towards the gay lifestyle. But anyway, let's read a little bit from this article. Pam Strong is the person that is being spoken of here. She is the homosexual teacher that uses her position as a teacher to advance what's called the LGBTQ classroom environment. Now, what does LGBTQ stands for? It stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, and queer. And the title of this is LGBTQ Classroom Conversation Starters. This is for four-year-olds. Of course, as a Christian, this is tragic. I remember how much Jesus loved little children and said, "Let the little children come unto me." And he talked about one who offends one of these children, you know, over in Matthew 18, let a millstone be tied around his neck and let him be cast into the sea. And Jesus had a particular love for children because of their vulnerability and their childlike faith. And here we see what Satan is doing with these children in our day. He's trying to brainwash them very early, starting at age four, at least in Canada, and indoctrinate them into the gay lifestyle. Anyway, this article says, Pam Strong, this is the lesbian teacher that's doing this, called it key to develop a positive classroom culture. She mentioned it often takes months before getting into what she called difficult conversations with students about convincing students of the abnormality of her preference for women. Excuse me, convincing students of the normality of her sexual preference for women. She mentioned how she spends time building a common vocabulary in her classroom of words like stereotype, prejudice, discrimination, so her students will be able to more readily conform to her pro-LGBTQ message. She says sometimes with these big ideas, there are also very big words that are very hard to understand. I find that whether it's kindergarten right up to grade six, visuals help a lot, she said. She goes on, the article goes on, and it says the lesbian teacher has amassed a collection of conversation starters that she says helps get her started when presenting to her students the LGBTQ message. She said pro-gay children's books are one of her favorites. And she's quoted here as saying, "I use current events, news articles, advertisements are great for gender, especially with kindergarten kids. Pink and girl toys and all the rest of it. Commercials are great. I use one right now, the Honeymaid commercial. The 2014 Dad and Papa commercial depicts two male same-sex partners engaging with their children in the normal family activities, such as making s'mores, eating dinner around the table, and walking in the park. Strong says that she watches the commercial with her students up to 3 times, asking them to make a list of all of the similarities between the gay partnership and their own families. Of course, they think it's going to be so different, that this family is going to be so different, she said. Strong said that kids notice dozens of similarities, but usually one difference, namely that the commercial has 2 dads. Other than this, she said, students could not find one thing in the commercial that was different from their own families. In this way, she convinces the kids that a gay partnership is identical to a family made up of a male and a female. Strong called it a fantastic lesson for kids of all ages. There was nothing left for me to teach at the end of it. It was a huge learning for some kids, she said. The article goes on and it says, though homosexual activists claim that their efforts in the schools are a way of combating bullying, a number of homosexual activists have highlighted that the movement's goal is in fact to indoctrinate children into accepting the normalcy of the homosexual lifestyle. I'm here to tell you, all that time I said I wasn't indoctrinating anyone with my beliefs about gay and lesbian, bi, trans and queer people, that was a lie, wrote Canadian gay activist Sassone Bear Bergman, a woman who identifies herself as a transgender man, in a March 2014 piece called "I Have Come to Indoctrinate Your Children into My LGBTQ Agenda, and I'm Not a Bit Sorry." Bergman holds back, stating that she wants to make children like us, even if that goes against the way you have interpreted the teachings of your religion. In 2011, U.S. gay activist Daniel Villarreal penned a column for Queerty.com stating that the time had come for the homosexual lobby to admit to indoctrinating school children into accepting homosexuality. This individual is quoted as saying, "Why would we push anti-bullying programs or social studies classes that teach kids about the historical contributions of famous queers unless we wanted to deliberately educate children to accept queer sexuality as normal? We want to teach educators to teach future generations of children to accept queer sexuality, and in fact, our very future depends on it. Recruiting children? You bet we are," he added. Homosexual activist Michael Swift wrote in 1987 in the Gay Community News that school children would become explicit targets for homosexual indoctrination. "We shall seduce them in your schools," he said. "They will be recast in our image. They will come to crave and adore us," he wrote at that time. And this was back in 1987. Now, why do I bring this to your attention? I bring this to your attention because I believe part of the gay agenda is to use schools, beginning at the age of 4, to indoctrinate kids. Now, here's a woman in Canada that admits doing it. She even shares with us in this article her teaching tactics that she uses to recruit children into the gay lifestyle. And even if 9 out of 10 people remain heterosexual, their attitude towards homosexuality through this early educational process will be changed. And they will look at homosexuality in an accommodating manner. And beyond that, you'll notice these quotes I've given from this article are from numerous gay activists that admit we are recruiting children to the homosexual lifestyle in your public schools, which, by the way, you're paying for with your own tax money. And beyond that, we're changing people's attitudes about homosexuality. So Michael Swift admits to it, a gay activist. Daniel Villarreal, a gay activist, admits to it. Sassoon Bergman, a gay activist, admits to it. And this is all out for anybody to see in this particular article entitled Lesbian Teacher, How I Convince Kids to Accept Gay Marriage Starting at 4 years of age. It's astonishing, the time period that we're living in, and how these things are happening right under our very noses. One of the things that's very interesting is they have used this argument about bullying as a way to get their agenda introduced into the classroom. Now, you remember in our last CD together, one of the things I brought up is this idea that there's some sort of mass victimization of gays through crime and violence and hate crimes, and how there's some sort of mass suicide rates amongst gays. All of that stuff is a myth. All of that stuff is emotion, but you have to separate emotion from fact. And I showed you statistically how those things are mythological. They're not true. But the reason the gay rights movement perpetuates these ideas is because they want to say, well, we've got all of this bullying against gays taking place in public schools, so we've got to get in there to show people that being gay is okay. The real goal is to recruit people into the gay lifestyle, and they have to recruit because they can't reproduce, and they really only represent 2% of the population anyway. And even if they 9 out of 10 students remain heterosexual, at least they can change the attitude of the remaining 90% so that they are not anti-gay. And they can portray them as bigots if they're resistors. But by and large, they want to change the attitude in culture about homosexuality. So as we move into Sodom's second coming, as the climate that Jesus predicted would one day, and I believe is, manifest itself upon the earth just prior to his return, we're seeing three realities. Number one, a loss of freedom, as I've tried to explain. Number two, homosexuality is being openly taught in school. Now, at this point, some people might be saying, well, gee, Andy, you've been pretty critical of homosexuality in these CDs that you've been doing. Are you perfect? Don't you have sins in your own life? And the answer to that is yes. Well, no, I'm not perfect. But yes, I do have sins in my own life. There are all kinds of things in my life that I'm trying to work through. I'm not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. I have sinful proclivities. Some of them I've conquered under the power of the Holy Spirit. Other sinful proclivities remain. But you see, here's the basic difference. I am not out trying to rewrite the Bible to accommodate my sinful proclivities. My sinful proclivities I am embarrassed by. I submit those over and over again to God, and I ask Him to change me, and He has been active in changing me in many areas, but I'm not trying to rewrite the Bible. I'm not trying to carve out special civil rights protection because of my sinful proclivities, and I'm certainly not going into the schools and trying to portray whatever my hang-up is as somehow normal. I'm not trying to indoctrinate innocent children. And so you see, the gay rights movement likes to play this little game of, well, you know, you guys in the Christian world, you know, you're very judgmental. You like to throw rocks. You're hypocritical because certainly you have sin in your own life. And all of us do have sin. Romans 3, verse 23 says, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. You know, I could have a sin with gluttony. I could have a sin with overeating. I could have a sin of being easily angered. Heterosexual lust is a sin that is common in the Christian community. But we are trying to change under the power of the Holy Spirit. We are not rewriting the Bible the way the gay rights movement is. We are not demanding special civil rights protection. We are not going around suing organizations that sit in judgment on whatever sinful proclivities that we have. And we're certainly not trying to indoctrinate naive school children. And that's basically the difference. So the gay rights movement, you know, likes to accuse us in the Christian world of being hypocritical and judgmental. But the fact of the matter is that's another apples and oranges comparison. For those of us in the Christian world, we're not claiming moral perfection. We've never claimed moral perfection. But we, as we work through our issues and problems, are not out to overhaul society the way the gay rights advocates are. And so when that argument is brought up by the gay rights community and advocates, they need to be called out on that. Yes, we are not sinless and perfect on our side of the aisle, but we're not rewriting the Bible either and suing organizations and trying to change the law and trying to overhaul straight society. And we certainly don't want to change our change the attitudes of young school children. We certainly don't want to recruit people into our lifestyle. So Sodom's second coming. The gay rights movement is being successful at portraying itself as a victim. Therefore, it gets elevated rights under the law. Once it gets that, it can use the legal system as a weapon to silence and harass opposition. And this has resulted in three realities. Number one, a loss of religious freedom. Number two, active proselytizing in the classroom. And then number three, let's move into a third reality, and this is what I call the slippery slope reality. By the way, before we leave the public school classroom, could you imagine the trouble we would get in today's climate if we went into the public schools and openly promoted Christianity and the Bible? And yet, why is it that the gay rights advocates can go into the public schools and actively promote homosexuality? The name of the game is recruitment. And if you can't recruit, then at least change the attitude of the remaining heterosexuals. And that's what this movement called Project 10 is all about. 10 means 10%. 10% comes from the discredited Kinsey study that I spoke of earlier. And that's this idea that we know that 10% of the population is gay, so therefore we need to get out there and convince fence sitters to join our movement. 10% of the population is gay, and there's a lot of people out there that are gay that don't realize they're gay. They just need to be convinced that they're gay. So let's get in there and recruit them into the gay lifestyle. That is what is happening in Canada. That is what is happening in California. And this is what is growing all over our nation, almost like a cancer. And I praise God for ministries like the Gathering Storm that can give us a forum where we can bring these things to light. But the third reality is something that I'll call the slippery slope argument. As this gay rights, legal and political agenda begins to achieve greater and greater success, what will happen? What will be the end result? What will be the end game? Will it stop with homosexuality, or will it go on into other more perverse forms of sexuality? Of course, the answer to that question is, as homosexuality becomes tolerated and accepted and even endorsed and embraced, things are not going to stop with the gay lifestyle. What you're going to see are other more perverse lifestyles that are now going to be accepted and adopted and embraced as well. Now, there's something out there called a thruple. How do you spell thruple? Well, you spell it just like couple, but instead of C-O-U-P, you spell it this way, T-H-R-O-U, and then put the pel at the end, thruple, just like a couple. What is a thruple? Well, a couple is two people in a relationship. A thruple, then, is three people. So I'm holding an article in my hand entitled Married Lesbian Thruple Expecting First Child in the New York Post. And this is dated April 23rd, 2014. So Married Lesbian Thruple, T-H-R-O-U-P-L-E. Spell that just like couple, C-O-U-P-L-E. Except with a couple, you're talking about two in a relationship. With a thruple, you're talking about three. Let me just read you a little bit from this article. It says, here comes the brides, plural. Three Massachusetts lesbians claim they got married to each other and are now expecting their first child. Doll, Kitten, and Bryn Young exchanged vows in a commitment ceremony last August, with all three brides wearing white and traditional wedding veils. I cried watching Doll and Kitten walk down the aisle toward me with their dads, Bryn told the Sun newspaper of London. After we said our vows, Doll and Kitten kissed me first and then each other. No state in the union recognizes three-way marriages, but these women insist their unconventional union is very real to them. In our eyes, we are married, said Bryn, age 34, a computer programmer. We had specialist lawyers draw up the paperwork, so our assets are equally divided. Bryn and Kitten were married 2.5 years ago in Massachusetts before adding Doll to their household mix. The youngest of the three, Kitten, is 6 months pregnant via an unknown sperm donor. Now, we look at this and we say this is just morally outrageous. What are you talking about, three people getting married? Well, my answer to that is, why not? I mean, if two same-sex people can be married on the basis that they're born that way and we ought not to discriminate against them, then why can't three people get married? Can't the thruple make the same argument that any homosexual couple makes? Can't they say you're being judgmental for not accepting us? Can't they also change the civil rights laws? Can't they also change the adoption laws? Can't they also change the marriage code? Once we start looking at lifestyles as civil rights, then the civil rights status and the marital status that's given to a homosexual couple can easily be given to a thruple. I mean, I would see this thruple making the identical argument that a homosexual gay or lesbian couple would make. And the fact of the matter is, why stop with a thruple? Why not have a quartet? Why not have four people getting married? Four people all of the same sex getting married. How about two men and an animal getting married? How about two men and an underaged adult or younger child or teenager getting married? You see, there's virtually no limitation or stopping point once the gay agenda takes root. Once the homosexuals say, accept us because we're born that way, give us special rights, protection under the law, and so forth, and once we move in the direction of looking at behaviors and lifestyle choices as equivalent of a civil right, then any group, a throuple, a quartet, or any group that you can imagine will be demanding the same rights. And this is what I call the slippery slope, or opening up Pandora's box. And if that weren't bad enough, the argument that is beginning to surface now that the gay lifestyle is becoming entrenched is the pedophilia argument. Here is an article entitled, "Pedophilia is Not a Crime," says Rutgers professor Margot Kaplan. Margot Kaplan, in the Monday edition of the New York Times, the Rutgers Camden law professor, an NYU and Harvard graduate, took to the op-ed pages to argue that we've got it all wrong when it comes to pedophilia. She writes that pedophiles don't necessarily turn out to be child molesters, and that pedophilia is not a choice, i.e., a pedophile might be born that way. So here we've got a leader in the legal community, an academician. She apparently has first-rate academic credentials in terms of where she graduated from. She teaches at a fairly elite law school, the Rutgers Camden University Law School, rather. She's a law professor there. She graduated from NYU. She's a Harvard graduate. And this is what she said October 5th, 2014, in the New York Times op-ed piece. Quote, "Think back to your first childhood crush. Maybe it was a classmate or a friend next door. Most likely, though, through school and into adulthood, your affections continued to focus on others in your approximate age group. But imagine if they did not. By some estimates, 1% of the male population continues long after puberty to find themselves attracted to prepubescent children. These people are living with pedophilia, a sexual attraction to prepubescence that often constitutes a mental illness. Unfortunately, our laws are failing them and consequently ignoring opportunities to prevent child abuse." A second misconception, she says, or a misconception rather, is that pedophilia is a choice. Recent research, while often limited to same-sex offenders because of the stigma of pedophilia, suggests that the disorder may have neurological origins. Pedophilia could result from a failure in the brain to identify which environmental stimuli would provoke sexual response. MRIs of same-sex offenders with pedophilia show fewer of the neural pathways known as white matter in the brains. Men with pedophilia are 3 times more likely to be left-handed or ambidextrous, a finding that strongly suggests a neurological cause. Some findings also suggest that disturbances in neurodevelopment in utero or early childhood increase the risk of pedophilia. Studies have also shown that men with pedophilia have on average lower scores of tests of visual, spatial ability, and verbal memory. She goes on and she says the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 prohibit discrimination against otherwise qualified individuals with mental disabilities in areas such as employment, education, medical care. Congress, however, explicitly excluded pedophilia from protection under those two crucial laws. It's time to revisit these categorical exclusions. Without legal protection, a pedophile cannot risk seeking treatment or disclosing his status to anyone for support. He could lose his job and future prospects if he is seen at a group therapy session, asks for reasonable accommodation to take medicine, or see a psychiatrist, or request a limit in his interaction with children. Isolating individuals from appropriate employment and treatment only increases the risk of committing a crime. Now, you know, in her defense, she's not in favor of pedophiles molesting children. I mean, thank God for that. What she's basically arguing here is pedophilia is simply it's a disorder. It's not a crime. It's something you're born with. And as long as the pedophile is not hurting anybody, then, you know, we should not be discriminating against pedophiles in employment situations. In other words, pedophiles also should be granted elevated special protection under the law. Now, this is if you've been following my teaching on this, this is exactly what the gay rights activists have been saying. This is exactly what has been entrenched in our society. And if we're going to accept the homosexual arguments, then why can't the pedophiles make the same arguments? And you see, Pandora's box is opened, and the slope, as we can see, is very slippery. The fact of the matter is there is no logical basis to say no to thruples or quartets or to pedophiles. There's no reason to deny them the same status under the law as gained by homosexuals because they're all making the exact same arguments. Once you move away from immutable characteristics into behavior as a basis for giving people elevated status under the law, then virtually any perverse, deviant, foisting any behavior whatsoever could qualify. And so it's just a very tragic direction that our society is moving in. In fact, I remember even back in the 1990s observing gay rights parades. I remember that marching after those parades towards the back after the homosexuals had gone by in their parade was a group called the what's called NAMBLA. N-A-M-B-L-A, that stands for the North American Man-Boy Love Association. Now, why was this group advocating marital relationships between men and boys? Why were they marching right after a gay rights parade? Well, the answer is they were making the same arguments that the homosexuals were making. We're born this way. We're not hurting anybody. Don't devalue us. Embrace us for what we are. And, you know, my reaction at the time was, well, why not? You know, if we're going to buy into the gay rights argumentation, why not buy into the argumentation of the Man-Boy Love Association? Why not buy into the argumentation of the pedophiles? Why not buy into the argumentation of those that are promoting thruples or quartets? And what... we're going to pay a massive price for Sodom's second coming. Number one, three realities. Number one, a loss of freedom. Number two, the active proselytizing of the homosexual lifestyle in the school system. And number three, this slippery slope, Pandora's box kind of argument that now we're moving into embracing all kinds of other perverse lifestyles. When we talk about this issue of public schools, backing up just for a moment, we see very strongly the need for homeschooling. Once I began to see many of these things taking place in public schools, I began to recognize that the public schools of today are quite different than the ones I grew up in. I am a product of public schools. I spent K through 12 in public schools, but I do not remember this aggressive agenda taking place in the public school classrooms when I was a youth. But that is what is taking place today, and that's why my wife and myself have made a decision to homeschool our daughter. And I would just encourage any Christian family that happens to be out there listening to some of the things I've been talking about to seriously consider that as an option. If there's any economic possibility or any way you can do it, I would highly recommend it. I would also recommend the option of private Christian schools if you can afford it, because the most important asset we are given by God is the minds and the training of our children. And, you know, I don't remember God telling Joshua when he conquered the Canaanites back in the book of Joshua. He didn't say, go in and enroll your, you know, after you wipe out some of the Canaanites, I want you to enroll your children in Canaanite schools. That wouldn't make any sense at all, because you would raise a bunch of God haters, wouldn't you, through that process, not God lovers and God fearers. What the book of Joshua says is go in. Now, this is Old Testament Israel, so it's obviously different in terms of what Israel was to do, but they were to eradicate the Canaanites completely. And according to Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 through 7, they were to raise up their own children in the fear of the Lord. And when we turn our children over to all of these social experiments that are happening today in public schools, we need to really ask ourselves, are we doing the will of God? I don't think we are. I think we're turning over our most important asset to enemy ground. So the gay agenda. What does the Bible say about it? Genesis through Revelation. We saw that in CD number one. In CD number two, we took a look at the political and the legal agenda behind the gay rights movement, the desire to, in essence, position yourself as a civil rights minority, even though you don't meet the criteria, and to use your newfound legal status as a weapon to punish objectors to the homosexual lifestyle. We have also seen how this mindset fits perfectly with today, given Christ's predictions that as it was in the days of Sodom, so shall it be at the return of Christ, as this moral climate resurfaces in the last days. And we've looked at some terrible trends in our culture as a result of it: loss of freedom, proselytizing in the schools, and this slippery slope Pandora's box argument. Well, I've got a couple minutes left. What do we do about it? I just want to leave you with four thoughts. I think if all Christians were doing these four things, then our world would be a lot better place. Number one, pray. 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 through 4 says we should pray for kings and all who are in authority so that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness. Are we really in prayer for our leaders who are making all of these political decisions on our behalf and who are accommodating, in many respects, the gay lifestyle? We need to be on our knees and pray for decision makers that have influence in this area. Number two, educate yourself on this. That's where CDs like this are so helpful. Hosea 4 and verse 6 says, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. God's people are not destroyed for a lack of dedication, zeal, or activity, but for a lack of knowledge. Most Christians just do not know what is going on. 1 Chronicles 12 and verse 32 says, of the sons of Issachar, they were men who understood the times and therefore had a knowledge of what Israel should do. Do you understand the times? Are you educating yourself about these types of issues? Do you have the ability to see through the propaganda and teach others how to see through the propaganda? And then number three, get out and vote. You know, it's tragic. Of all of the evangelical Christians in America, only half of them are registered to vote. Of those that are registered to vote, only half of that group shows up and actually votes. And of the Christians that actually vote, many of them don't vote biblical principles. They vote based on their party affiliation, the way their parents voted. Are they going to get that new government contract through their job at work? But we need to get into the polls, polling place, and we need to vote Bible every single time. And we're not owners, but we're stewards of many things like time, talent, and treasure. And one of the things God has given us stewardship for stewardship of is our own government, given our free participatory system that we have here. And then finally, number four, don't lose hope. Things look like they're falling apart, but in reality, they might very well be falling into place, as Jesus told us the signs that would precede his coming. So I hope these studies on the Gay Agenda have been helpful to you, and God bless you.